Welcome back to the Focus on Agriculture podcast. I'm your host, Preston.
And I'm Jason.
Well, Jason, welcome back. It's been a little bit of a break here we've taken from recording podcasts, but I'm excited because today we restarted the podcast with quite the bang.
Yeah, it was. We had a great guest. We had Ambassador Kip Thom, who was the ambassador to the UN under President Trump, the ambassador to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, that a lot of our listeners have probably heard of, probably don't really know what it is. That was the case with me.
For sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I appreciated, a lot of the conversation that Kip brought to the table, especially his background in agriculture, his dedication to the legacy that he's building on his farm, and having that legacy transcend through the generations. You know, I forget, it was 1837 was when his farm was established in Indiana. But just a tremendous legacy as a farmer, also just a real heart for, you know, America, American farmers. And he's obviously fully dedicated to preserving that legacy, whether on his own farm or more broadly speaking, the American farmer.
Yeah. And as we talked about with him, as he pointed out in the podcast, when he was the ambassador, there was 194 other ambassadors. I don't want to give it all away, but he was basically the only one who was a farmer. And to have a farmer like that in politics and in geopolitical situations is really important. I think it's an important role that is overlooked oftentimes.
For sure. So I would say if there's one key takeaway, I think Kip does a great job at just encouraging farmers to tell their story, to engage in politics, whether that's local or, you know, even federal in his case. I think that the future is bright. There are some threats to agriculture that Kip mentioned, but, you know, really there's a lot of things to look forward to. So without further ado, let's get right into the conversation with Kip. Well, welcome to the podcast, Kip. It's great to have you on today. To kick things off, would you mind telling us a little bit about your background and what you're up to now?
Well, sure. Our family actually came to the United States back in about the mid-1600s. And don't worry, I'm not going to go into all the details here, but mid-1600s, we've always been farmers and gradually made our way across Pennsylvania and Ohio, and landed in Indiana about 1837, and been here for seven generations. I'm the seventh. I got my children of the eighth generation today. I got out of high school and started farming right away. We've grown a business over the years, but today we produce corn and soybeans. We're a buyer seed producer, and we got grain operations, merchandising, and we also invest in a lot of different ag tech as well. So, and then most recently, just a few years ago, I served under President Trump in his administration. I was a representative of the ambassador to the World Food Programs at FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, based in Rome, Italy, where I lived. And I spent a lot of time traveling the world and looking at agriculture systems and seeing what works, what didn't work, try to make recommendations of what I could use of my past history in farming and try to improve lives and livelihoods in some of those developing countries. So today I'm back home, I'm farming, I'm still continuing the mission of talking about the innovation that resides in U.S. agriculture and within companies like Bayer and others that are really contributing to improving those lives and livelihoods. And I'm really optimistic about the future of agriculture.
That's incredible. And you have such a varied range of experience. And that's one reason why we wanted to talk to you here today. So I think, you know, there's so many things to talk about, but just want to talk a little bit about your farming and your farming operation. You mentioned you're this seventh generation now. It's been in the family for almost 200 years there in Indiana. You've grown that farm over the years. And if I'm not mistaken, you've also expanded into South America a bit. Is that accurate?
Yeah, we operated, we produced seed in Argentina for about 20 years. Then we pulled out of any involvement at all in Argentina. Prior to that, I did some consulting for a seed business in Chile, Argentina, and Brazil. And that was the lure that got me interested in doing something in Argentina. And we still feel we had an impact on the supply chain and the way seed is produced down there. But it came a certain point in time, they may have had some of the best soils in the world, but if you have a government that's not cooperating with you at that time, we just felt it was best to reinvest back in the United States.
That's kind of what I was curious about, that kind of the differences between the you know, we always have things to that we're maybe not happy about the way things are going from governmental policy, right? Everybody has room to complain. But when we compare and contrast what we have in the U.S. compared to other countries, such as Argentina that you referenced, where the government maybe isn't so friendly to agriculture, can you speak a little bit to that, or, you know, some of those differences?
Well, you know, Argentina is an example. You know, the biggest industry to support their economy is agriculture. And it seems as though every time the government needed money, they would come up with a new tax that they would place on agriculture. And it just became very burdensome. There was also a specific level of corruption that occurred as well. But the reality is, I still think under their new leadership today, they're going to be a stronger nation. I think agriculture is actually going to flourish. But there's a lot to learn. You know, you go into a lot of these foreign countries in the world and you think that we are the best in the United States. We're the only ones that have the solution here. And there's always, you always come away from some of these different countries, whether it's in a developing nation across Africa or one that's fairly developed in Latin America, you'll come home with some idea that you can bring back to your business and probably have an impact. At the same time, you know, I switched continents here a little bit. You know, just back in February, I was in Europe, and I went and met with some of our friends, fellow farmers from Belgium, and a few from France. And it was really interesting because it was during the time when they were protesting. You know, I think most of the people in our industry saw the tractors driving into capitals of the nation and protesting, and sometimes some little violent, and then a lot of activities taking place. Well, I wanted to talk to some of the farmers that were involved, and I talked to also some farmers who were trying to take a diplomatic approach to it. And one thing that I learned, I asked them this question. I said, is there any message I could take back to United States producers in what's going on here now, and how can we avoid these same kind of consequences that you're experiencing here in Europe? And one comment was always, it was a constant amongst everybody I talked to, and that was, you know, when you expect to continue to get more subsidies, understand that with those subsidies, there are going to be some kind of restriction or something that impedes your progress to adopt innovation. And so when I bring that up, I'm talking about the Farm to Fork initiative. And Europe is a good example of that, where they want to reduce pesticide usage 50%, fertilizer use 40%. They don't want to use some of the modern genetic tools that we have today and the hybrids that we use on our farms to prevent and increase productivity and prevent the yield impact from insects or diseases. So what I came back with was, remember, our independence is worth hanging on to if we can, and make sure that we don't ask for too much from the government to in our farming.
Fascinating. I think I heard you say 1860. Is that the correct date?
Yeah,
1837. That's quite the legacy that you and your family have built over the years. I'm just curious. I'm assuming you said eighth generation, so your offspring are currently involved in the day-to-day operations.
Yeah, I've got children involved in it. I got a grandson that just graduated from Purdue University with an ag management degree. I've got a granddaughter that's graduating with an agronomy degree. You know, they're probably going to go work somewhere else for a little bit, but hopefully someday they'll make the decision to come back and keep the family business going.
Isn't that what every farmer wants? Basically, they want their kids and their family to come back. And you know, all this talk, we've had podcasts where we've talked about different sustainability initiatives and things like that, and that can be kind of a buzzword, right? But really, I always feel like at the root, sustainability means being able to pass on the farm to your descendants in a better shape, or as good of shape, at least, as you received it, right? And I think that's kind of what it comes down to for almost every farmer that you visit with.
Hey, you know, I have never met a farmer, whether man or woman, that has ever made the comment, I don't want to turn my farm over to my children. You know, they always, it's their aspiration, it's their goal. You know, from the time that child, like I, as a child growing up behind my father, I couldn't wait to get outside, walk behind him, even at a very young age. And just the curiosity at that age and the ability to learn how to, you know, whether it was feeding cattle, the hogs, or learning to drive a tractor or growing a crop, it was those experiences that everyone hopes to pass on to their children and hope they pass it on to their children and keep that legacy going.
You know, and I want to reference one other thing that for those who are listening to this on, you know, not seeing the video, but you have in your background there, you have a plow behind you. Can you tell us, you mentioned the significance of that kind of briefly when before we started recording, but can you tell us about that plow?
Yeah, certainly. So actually, I bought this plow at my grandfather's estate auction, and he was going to give it to me. I said, no, I think I need to pay for it. And then he passed, and it was at the auction, and I bought it, I think, for $200 back in 1980 or something like that. But it's a plow. It dates back to 1860. My great-great-great-grandfather bought it. We got some documents that show where they, you know, they went by horse-drawn wagon and went up to South Bend, Indiana, which is about, well, I don't know what it is back then and how they got there, but it's probably 50 miles away. So a several day trip to go up, and he bought this at the Oliver Plow Works in South Bend, Indiana, and brought it back to the farm. And that's what he broke the ground with. But it's, I wake up every morning and I walk by this plow, and I go to bed, I walk by this plow, and it just takes you back to where we came from. And I think we need to do that more often as farmers, because I can recall a conversation standing with my grandfather next to the fence, and my dad was out in the field plowing, and I forget what tractor it was, but he brought up the conversation. He goes, I can remember back in the 1920s when he got his first tractor, the neighbor came over and said, well, now you got a tractor, what are you going to do with all your hay? Because you're not going to keep horses around, you know? And so just think about how we've evolved in agriculture over the past 100 years, where we came from, where we were thinking about increasing the protein in the diet of our horse so they were strong enough to go out here and pull one of these things through the field. To today, you know, we're talking to our data scientists, talking about the algorithms that we're going to change as we seed our crop this coming spring, or maybe something we're doing and changing the variable rate fertilizer or see and spray technologies. I'm so proud of our industry, how far we've went over the past 100 years, but I think I can say this with a lot of confidence. I think we're just at the beginning of the growth curve of what how we're going to see innovation play out for our industry. So going back to the plow, to where we are today, I'm excited, but I'm even more excited about the future.
Yeah, we definitely, I know Preston and I have had several conversations where we've talked about history. We really love to talk about history and where we've been, but we're also equally excited. We share that sentiment, you know, where we're going. I think it's a very great time to be an ag.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so valuable to have intergenerational presence on the farm, right? You know, you said a grandson coming from Purdue, and just the technology advancement is happening so rapidly. It's nice to have that next generation there with their feet on the dirt, and just helping you guys scale and implement these new innovations.
Yeah, and I think it's important, you know, that they experience failure too. You know, I think I go back to some of my early days. I started a family. I was fairly young, and you know, I was in the midst of the 1980s farm depression. And you know, so I go back and I recount some of those days, just how we tried to get by. You know, land values went from $3,000 an acre to $1,100 an acre in this ground. Corn was selling for sub $1.80. Our cost of production was probably 2.25 at the time. It was living through that that really probably grew us more to make us who we are today, make us better, because we learned from those experiences, and we learned when we needed to pull in our horns a little bit and prepare and save and be prepared for the next downturn, because there's going to be opportunities if you do have a downturn.
Yeah, that's a really great point, and I think it's great advice for young folks, young men and young women. We have a lot of students that listen to this podcast, or young folks, and I think when you're young and you fail, sometimes you think it's the end of the world, but I think we've all been around long enough at this point that you can learn from failure, and it can be ultimately a good experience. And, you know, the saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, isn't always true, but it is pretty true a lot of the time.
Yeah, you know, I look at some of my own kids, and yeah, they remember growing up during the 1980s and just how difficult it was for us. But at the same time, I look at where they're at today, they're experiencing it from a different level. Let's say, for instance, we do have somewhat of a downturn in the ag cycle right now over the next few years here, because obviously we know that we've got excess supply, global exports are off. Thank goodness we have the value-add opportunities we have here in the United States, from biofuels to increased animal production. But the reality is we could see a little bit of a downturn. And I don't think we're going to see anything like we did in the 80s, but hopefully we never have to experience that. Hopefully they don't have to experience it. But you want to set the stage in their mind. It makes you feel like you're really old when you start saying this stuff. But I remember when, and but we do need to remember when, and we need to share those stories with the next generation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to switch gears just a little bit here. And again, I'm going to reference your background there. On your other shoulder, you have an American flag. And so, you know, obviously, you know, I think that's come out already in the conversation. That's important to you. You know, you love this country. And you actually started at some point in your career to get involved in politics, which is interesting because, you know, as you mentioned, you're just a regular farm kid. How did that happen, that you started to get involved in politics?
You know, some people remind me, there used to be magnet on our a little sticker on our refrigerator said, help me, I've decided to run for office. I've fallen off my medications, you know. It's not a true story, but some people said that would apply. But, you know, I'll be honest with you, I never went to a Lincoln Day dinner at a Republican event until probably in the 2014 or 15. I really wasn't politically engaged even prior to that. I decided in 2015 to run for House of Representatives, Congress in Washington, D.C. And that kind of opened up my view of the world and understanding a little bit more what goes on in politics and how politics and public policy really shape what happens here on the farm. Yeah, we have to implement at the farm level, but at the same time, we better make sure that we've got the policy in Washington allows agriculture to flourish and those around us. You know, so whether you're talking about those that produce crop care products for us or the genetics or those upwards in the food supply chain, we've got to have the regulatory bodies that are functioning properly. And this is where Congress comes in, and they need to make sure that they're talking from their halls and their chambers and on top of the hill down into Washington, D.C., and talking to these different bodies to make sure that we have the ability to flourish. So, but that's when I got started, probably about 2015. So not that long ago. I was more focused on growing a business, raising a family, making sure ends meet, looking at new opportunities. And I hope more people take the challenge to get involved in politics, or I hate to use that word, I'd say more involved in policy discussions. And I think, you know, every time I travel around the United States, I tell farmers it's, you can leave the discussion up to the commodity organizations, whether it's corn growers or soybean, wheat, cotton, whatever it may be. But the reality is you need to get involved as an individual. Call up your senator, U.S. senator, call up your state representative. Talk to people when you walk out of church on Sunday if they question why you're doing what you're doing on your farm. We have to, as individuals, it's just as important as driving that tractor. It's just as important picking that seed genetics out that you're going to use in your farm. You've got to get involved in the discussion, and you need to know what's going on around you. And most importantly, realize it's not just what happens in the United States. It's what happens around the world in Apexus, because agriculture has a role to play everywhere, and mainly U.S. agriculture.
It's really easy for all of us farmers and everyone to really get kind of a narrow focus on what has to be done and focus on, you know, getting the crop in the ground and marketing that crop and all those things. And I think you make a great point about, you know, taking a little broader look at what's going on around us. It definitely affects us, right?
It does. So when I think about, you know, what's going on globally, and I look at what can impact U.S. farmers, I look oftentimes to what's going on in the BRICS. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and how they are trying to supplant the United States' ability to trade around the world. They want to replace us as the dominant economic power. And I think Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping of China made the comment when they walked out of the Kremlin about a year ago, January, said, who would have thought we would have the world under our control this soon? And I really think that they're making some big advances on trade and trying to have an impact there. So.
Yeah. Back to the farmers, you know, I think I agree with everything you said. Obviously, farmers, there's fewer and fewer as we progress through time. I think it's harder to tell for a farmer to tell his or her story. Do you have any actionable advice on for farmers? A lot of those guys, you know, maybe listen to this podcast, driving machinery. How do they share their voice, to share their story in a practical sense?
Yeah, I think it starts out with being informed, you know, follow the issues. You know, I love to consume as much information as I can, whether it's through ag channels that focus on agriculture and activities there and farming, or whether it's a Wall Street Journal, New York Times, or maybe different other journals from around the world. But I try to get a sense of what's going on around the world that really helps you get an idea of just how global agriculture is and how they need to have a voice there. But I think, so be informed, have the conversation with some of your cohorts, other farmers in the community, and try to create that atmosphere of where you're sharing ideas and thoughts about what's going on around the world, and others will grow along the way with this too. And then I think you go on from there and you talk to, you know, your state senators, members of the House, and then you go on to the federal government, talk to some of those people. But again, you know, commodity organizations play a critical role. They need to do what they need to do. You need to help support them. But listen, when you walk into a congressional member's office by yourself, it carries a lot of weight.
Well, that's great advice. And I think it's, you know, for myself, it's not something I would think of. So it's good to hear it from your perspective and the experience that you've had, that kind of advice. You started to get involved in politics. You started to network, learn, you know some people, no doubt. I'm just really interested to hear about this call that you received when, you know, did the president call you and ask you to be the ambassador to the UN? How did that go?
Yeah, well, I thought it was a joke to start with. And I thought, was that really him? It sounded kind of like him. And I told him after he asked me, explain a little bit, there was another person came on the call then. And I made the comment, well, I really need, before I answer, I want to know more about the role. So I'll review it, research it this weekend, and I'll get back to you. I didn't take it instantly. And I'm sure there's people who probably would have, but I wanted to know if I was qualified to fill the role, because it's an important role. I mean, it was, we actually had oversight over the second largest budget in international organizations next to NATO. So it was a sizable mission. We had a footprint around the world, exposure everywhere. We were delivering food aid to about 80 plus countries. We were involved in creating resilience and capacity in food systems or farming systems in about 140. So I felt I could have some qualifications to go out there and communicate what needed to happen. What I didn't realize is that, you know, I had worked with 194 ambassadors. And even though the U.S. is the largest contributor to this program, you still only have one vote out of 194. And so it's a challenge in trying to get work done within the U.N. system, but we shouldn't give up. We need to remain engaged.
I didn't even think about, you know, I think about it as such an important role that you were in, but then you think about your one voice out of 194, and everybody has different agendas, and probably some of them are, you know, I don't know. I guess I would like to assume they all have the best interest of, you know, agriculture at heart, but maybe that wasn't always the case. I don't know.
Well, you know, I would say this, you know, oftentimes I would have those discussions with other ambassadors one-on-one, and you had to go through some farming 101 courses with them to help them understand why we do what we do. But the reality is they would leave there and they say, well, we need to revert to capital to get an opinion on what you're trying to accomplish here. And so that always slowed it down. But the reality is there are a lot of good people there that work there. But at the end of the day, their capitals will dictate what they're going to do. And when I look at the European system, they're the ones that's been driving the bureaucracy at the one organization, FAO. They're very slow to move, and they have a big belief in the European food system. And I still contend to this day that they're probably why we haven't made the progress across the continent, like Africa, that we should be making.
So just curious, not to necessarily belabor the point, but were you one of the few farmers that were, you know, an ambassador on that panel, or were there other farmers, you know, people with farm experience also?
You know, so I did survey that, and because I wanted to know who I was talking to, but for the director general, Qu Dangzhu from China, he had about 2 hectares of production, or 5 acres, let's say. And then there was another person from Southeast Asia that had a few hectares that they operated. Other than that, most of them were career diplomats that knew how to navigate the UN bureaucracies and negotiate and work on different treaties around food and agriculture. But at the end of the day, no, there wasn't. I was the only farmer voice there.
Wow. I think that underscores your earlier point about the importance of farmers making their voice be heard. Both, and maybe that's even the case in the U.S. I don't know what the history of who's held that role, but probably even in the U.S., you maybe were a little bit unique as a farmer voice.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever been a farmer served in that capacity at the UN food-based agencies and ag agencies in Rome, but. Nonetheless, there were people there that had the support and the belief of supporting U.S. agriculture. I mean, we did so much different work. I mean, it was not only developing, creating resilience and capacity in food systems with FAO. It was feeding, you know, 150 million people around the world, 3 meals a day in 80-some countries. We had this one body within the FAO called CODEX. And CODEX would actually... would look at different chemistries that we would use. A new chemistry comes out that say Bayer or some company produces, it's got to get clearance through CODEX. Is it safe? What should be reentries? A lot of the details, the technical information about the product. And it's a very important body there. We need to maintain that engagement at CODEX because without it, we probably wouldn't have access to the products we do today. And even though that there's less and less that we're being allowed to use, but the reality is CODEX does serve a role that is instrumental for U.S. agriculture and global agriculture.
Kind of curious, did any procedures surprise you while you were there? I mean, when I think of American farming, you know, demand is usually more of a challenge. We're really good at producing large quantities, innovating technology to feed the future ever-growing global population, right? Was there any, you know, any bottlenecks that surprised you or any processes that surprised you when you were on the team?
Yeah, so the UN, as I said earlier, moves very, very slow. You've got trading blocks within the UN, you know, you may have the Europeans and then you got the Asians or you've got the Chinese that are maybe have a different view on things. And then you have the Nordic states that have even a different view yet. So it's always a shifting dynamics, and you need to understand what those dynamics are to understand the strategy of how do you bring more onto your side to get something accomplished. And then there's going through all the laws and procedures at the UN, which really slows things down. I mean, most of us in the corporate world or on our farms, you know, we decide we're going to do something, we'll go out and do it. At an organization like FAO, it takes years to get anything done. And there's never going to be a total agreement, but at the end of the day, there can be, they'll move it a little bit in one direction. I could share lots of stories about it. Some of it, you know, for instance, we had a person that was on the FAO's finance committee that had got caught up in a arms for food transaction, was He was convicted. He was in the United States working for the UN. He was actually convicted of a felony and served time in the United States. Well, I was summoned to go over to the Russian embassy at 2 o'clock in the morning to have a conversation about we need to withdraw him from serving on the finance committee again, because he was just served time as a felon, these charges against moving arms for food. And the Russian ambassador, after I made my point clear to him that we can't have him there, made the comment, well, but we brought him back from the United States and we found out that we tried him in court and he was innocent. And I said, of course you did. But the reality is, what happens is then you go into a vote for this person inside the FAO chambers of 194 people, and you find out you may be the only dissenting vote that wouldn't support him. So it's they tend to want to go against the U.S. oftentimes. You see that quite frequently. You got the G77 plus, and I don't want to get into the complexities of that, but it's a very different environment to function in that most of us are used to.
So does that even include countries that we would traditionally think of as our allies that would want to vote against us in a forum like that, or?
Actually, you know, and I need to backstep a little bit because of, you know, we have the Five Eyes, as we call them, or the nations that join together if there's ever any kind of global conflict. So you would find alignment between the United States, oftentimes Canada, of course, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand. We were always typically lined up most oftentimes. And then there would be times, it depend on the issue, but you might find some of the European nations, if they wanted to dissent from the EU on certain policy issues, would take a stand with the United States. Occasionally you find Argentina, as an example, would join up with us. For instance, if it was a discussion on cattle, animal health and well-being. It could be, we had conversations in about Brazil and use of GM crops. There was always conversations about deforestation. There's a lot of things that we joined together with other nations as well. And then once in a while you find some African nations that would line up with us, but then that even gets complicated because a lot of them have strong relationships with China. So if this is something that's going against China, they're obviously going to side up with China. So you got to game board it. You got to get that out and figure out what's going on here so you can make your right strategy move. So different than farming in Leesburg, Indiana, I'll say that. But I'll tell you what, they said, when I got there, they said, you're going to have to really sharpen your negotiation skills. And I said, I realize that, but I said, remember this. We rent land, and some of the times we rent land from 80-year-old plus widows. And I said, I've negotiated with them. I can negotiate with anybody. So it's true. So, but it was the role involved a lot of that, a lot of diplomacy. Sometimes you just had to bite your tongue and your lip and keep it to yourself. But at the end of the day, you wanted to get along. You want to make sure you got what you wanted to accomplish completed. And if you didn't, you came up with a strategy to how make another attempt at it to accomplish those goals.
Fascinating. Go in a different direction. I'm kind of curious, you know, with your background and your experience in agriculture, geopolitical topics, I know you mentioned BRICS nations. Have you changed how you quantify threats to agriculture, whether that's freedom to operate, internal regulations, maybe other countries investing in American cropland or stealing IP, things like that? Have the way you viewed those challenges or those threats changed at all? Or how do you quantify those? Or does that question make sense?
It does. Those threats have increased. Last week, I and Governor Noem testified in front of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Agriculture, and it was focused on the threats that China poses on to U.S. agriculture and our food system. And, you know, there's a lot of topics we can look at and discuss there, you know, whether it's the theft of our IP, seed genetics. We know we've got documented cases of that has occurred where they've actually got the seed back in China. We understand that, they've attempted to steal some of our farm level data taking it out of the country, taking it back to China to understand just how we operate and how we function on our farms here in the United States to increase productivity. And then there's, of course, always, the discussion around buying, Smithfield Foods. Did they buy them for the pork production, or did they buy them to understand the way the company functions and increases pork productivity and processes it? Given the growth in pork production in China, I'd say they probably learned a lot from that Smithfield acquisition 10 plus years ago. We look at others in the crop care side, by acquiring some of those companies, they picked up seed genetics that they didn't have access to in the past. They picked up some crop care products. 70% of U.S. Crop inputs, chemistries we use for crop care to prevent our crops from suffering from diseases, insects, or weeds is produced in China, where the tech material is. And so that, to me, that's a threat to U.S. agriculture. It's a threat to the United States, our own food security. So I think we need to work at making sure that we have the regulatory bodies in line to allow those different input suppliers or input manufacturers to bring that production back to the United States. Will we produce it cheaper here? I'm guessing probably not. But the reality is it's capital invested in the United States. It's jobs. It's assuring that supply chain to us. Listen, I don't know what happens if, as an example, if China invades Taiwan. What happens to that supply chain? So those are concerns of mine. I look at right now, you've got buyers trying to expand their one phosphorus mine, which is used to increase the production of glyphosate, safest chemistry we've had in decades to use on our U.S. farms. And there's some, because of the Endangered Species Act, they're actually trying to restrict their ability to expand that phosphate mine to produce glyphosate. We need that product, and we need it shored from the United States. So we're at more risk today than we've ever been. We've also been buying fertilizer from Russia. We haven't stopped, even during the Ukrainian war. Do I feel good as an American farmer knowing I'm buying nitrogen from a country that's using the income from, or the profits from that, to support the war against the Ukrainians, an unprovoked war? I don't feel good about it at all. But why did it happen? It's because of reductions in manufacturing of critical fertilizer components in the United States and in Europe. So I think we need to have a national strategy on agriculture, and we need to review some of these risks and make sure that the U.S. food system is resilient. Because I can tell you, traveling the world, there is no second America out there that picks up the pieces like we do. We do it, and we do it right, and we make sure that we distribute around the world, and we're still the best supplier.
Yeah, there's lots to unpack there. I mean, you mentioned supply chain. I think we got a little sneak peek at some of the vulnerabilities during COVID and some of those issues with supply chain, and the fact that a dozen eggs went up to, what, $6-$7 a dozen for a brief period of time, I appreciate that perspective.
And you mentioned earlier about the dangers of the government subsidizing things, and I think we all share those concerns. But then the government also does have a place in encouraging and building agriculture. What, you mentioned bringing some of that manufacturing or fertilizer back into the U.S., that sort of thing. What's the government's place in that, or what can the government do in a situation like that?
Well, as an example, you need to look at no further than the EPA. And, I think, and I don't want to get political here, but we have politicized the EPA to a certain extent to where we're not allowing much of this to go on in the United States. USDA, God bless them, they came out with a program to increase fertilizer production in the United States. There's been a number of plants announced. But then just shortly after, some of them stuck a shovel in the ground, started to build, and they came out with a new, more restrictive air emission standards that actually stop the projects from moving forward. Now, I don't know where they're at today, if they've got those issues corrected or what, but EPA needs to be, I'll say this, it needs to be well-funded to make sure we have enough people there working to get the products that we need on our farms and ranches to produce food, fiber, and energy. But the reality is we've got to stop being I say it. We got to have reliable and durable regulations. I want regulations, but they've got to be something that's reasonable. And to think that we can get down to parts per billion, or as the Europeans look at chemistries, they have a principle where they accept no residue at all, and even into the parts per billion. I think we need to let science do its work. And that's where the EPA really needs to pay attention to the science and make sure that they allow the products to the marketplace like we need. Let's face it, it takes, 16, 17 years to get a new chemistry onto the market, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more. And a lot of it goes off patent at year 17 or 18. So, we need to make sure that companies like Bayer and others have the bandwidth and the runway to continue to innovate, whether it's genetics or chemistries, to make sure we have the tools to be a preferred supplier in the world, providing food, fiber, and energy.
There's a reason why, and I don't know the exact number, but there haven't been any new chemistries launched in the United States from a weed control standpoint for 20 years, new modes of action, I believe. I don't know the exact time frame, but it's been a long time, is the bottom line.
Yeah, I think it's actually longer than that, but I think it's becoming a challenge. I mean, we're all facing farmers from whether you're in Louisiana or you're in Minnesota, you're facing resistance. And it's not because of lack of attempts to try to deal with the resistance. It's just that we're running out of solutions. I mean, we're bringing back some products that are still cleared by the EPA, still have the ability, the label allows us to use them, but we're trying to use all kinds of combinations to deal with resistance, and no more than get them out there and start working with them a little bit. And then they come up with the reason to pull them off the market. And a good example, that's what we've got what we were using in the dicamba and some of those products on soybeans. And we've got to make sure we have access to the products that are safe, reliable. They allow us to provide food, fiber, and energy at an affordable price, and keep our farms running efficiently.
For sure. Well, we've definitely highlighted some of the challenges, farmers face today, 2024. But I think we're also, on the cusp of so many different exciting technologies. When you, Kip, look to the future of agriculture, whether that's short, mid, or long term, what excites you most about the future of agriculture here in America?
We don't have enough time for that, but highlight. I'll say we all talk about machine learning and the computerization and how that's changing agriculture. I think AI is going to play a big role. Do I have caution flags? Do I have concerns about AI? I certainly do, as every American should. But the reality is, I think if we could get into gene editing as an example and use AI, I think it would be. It'd be interesting to see how fast we can bring a new line of seed genetics to the marketplace that solves problems that we face today. Instead of the usual timeline of 7, 8, 9, 10, 15 years, we can get something done in a very short period of time with AI. So I think companies like Bayer and others have done a lot in cataloging a lot of genetics, and hopefully those catalog genetics were able to utilize some of these AI technologies and bring advanced breeding to the farmer's farm gate sooner than later.
With your connections in Washington, what's your sense for the future of regulation in regards to gene editing? So currently gene editing is regulated a little bit differently than traditional genetic modification using the different techniques where we insert a gene. The editing has been looked at a little bit differently. Do you see that continuing, that allows companies to continue to make innovations, or do you think that's going to be more highly regulated in the near term?
Well, if we follow the model of Europe, it'd be more regulated, but let's hope sensible heads prevail, and we say, we continue to have the ability to innovate. We always had this saying, the U.S. innovates, China replicates, and the EU regulates.
Wow.
I, I hope we can keep
a t-shirt with that.
I hope we can keep the U.S. innovating, but it's going to take the regulatory bodies. They're going to have to be faster moving. They're going to have to be reliable. And as I said, durable, and make sure we allow these products to be tested, fully tested. We want to make sure they're, and no one wants to be more safe than the farmer. They're the ones handling it. They're the ones that's consuming it. We want to make sure the customer, the U.S. consumer, whether it's in Indiana or California or Sri Lanka or wherever in Japan, we want to make sure these products are safe. So we all have a vested interest, but we got to make sure these regulatory bodies in Washington are functioning in an ability to allow these new innovations, such as gene editing, to play a greater role.
Perfect. Well, we're here up at the end of the hour, Kip. We appreciate your time. Just one last question. We're at the time of recording, it's March 27th, 2024. How far out is your farm from dropping seed into the ground this year for plant 2024?
Oh, it's a secret. We can't tell you. I think we started this call asking if anyone planting around you, because farmers always curious about who's the first one to plant. We're always quick to say, it's too early. It's too cold. You know what? I would say, our usual timeline is in probably that second week of April. Hopefully get going on corn, maybe a little sooner on beans. We've got some acreage worked and ready to roll on both corn and beans, and we'll get moving pretty fast here when it breaks. But again, I'm looking forward, as every farmer does, the springtime of year. It's excitement. It's, you got new technologies on the equipment. You've got maybe some new genetics. Maybe you've switched up your crop care and your agronomy program a little bit. You're looking for some increases in productivity. And, we're always optimistic. I love plant season. When the planters make the first pass out through the field, you have this little bit of, I hope everything's going right. But, as soon as the seed starts coming up, it gives you the reality that it's going to be okay.
It's the second best time of the year, right? Harvest is like Christmas, because you get to see harvest. The results of all that. But
there's it used to be the day when you got in the combine, you kind of monitored how quick that grain tank filled up. Or back in the day when we used to pick ear corn back in the 60s, you look how fast the wagon filled up with that ear corn. But today I can be anywhere in the world and I can pull up on the screen. I can pull off the monitor in a combine live or after the fact, and you can see just whether you did something right or wrong. And so our ability to make decisions is going to continue to improve, and the rapid change of increase is going to continue to get faster. So I'm excited about agriculture. We're a great industry, and it's made up a lot of great people. I just encourage young people to give it a good look and come on out. There's a lot of good things happening here.
And there's definitely a need for bright minds of all stripes, right? All kinds of backgrounds. People kind of get tied up in, the farming is for the farm kids or whatever. But there are so many opportunities today with a computer programmer that also likes growing things can totally get involved in agriculture or any other stripe. So, yeah, it's an exciting time for sure.
Sure.
It is. Yeah. We're running out of farm kids there. As we continue to see decline in farm numbers and people connected to agriculture, we do need to reach out into some of those other industries for people to employ. And that's why I say I'm excited, because I think it gets those people going back into their urban audiences. Some of them come from and say, no, wait a second, here's how we really do it. And here's why you need to trust the products that we're producing, because they're making a difference. And describe some of the hurdles we face in agriculture beyond weather.
Well, Kip, it's been a great honor to talk with you today. We really appreciate your time. We'd love to actually get you on again in the future and dive into some of these stories a little bit more if time allows. But thank you for your time here today.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you, and look forward to connecting in the future.
The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the program hosts or their employer.